Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Can money really buy you happiness? We're going to talk about that big, big question about the connection between money and satisfaction with life. Former financial post writer, money expert, columnist Melissa Leong will be here. She has a new book out called Happy Go Money. And looking forward to a life free from work but don't know where to begin? Larry Swedrow is the co-author of Your Complete Guide to a Successful and Secure Retirement. He joins us to share some tips from his new book on the prep involved in that. And bringing to life Canadian statistics, Kip Spiddell on his CBC television show, The Stats of Life. Plus author and millennial Connor Richardson is here to tell us about his new book, Millennial Money Makeover. All that is ahead. Let's get started. They say money can't buy you happiness, perhaps, but it's also fair to say that money and happiness are pretty closely linked, in our minds at least. Personal finance columnist Melissa Leong has written a book that looks at many of those connections and how to make them work for you. She is the author of Happy Go Money. Hello there, Melissa.
Hi, Bruce.
Now, disclaimer, I'm so happy to be talking about the disclaimer here is I have known about this book for a long time and I have been rooting for you. And I'm so, so glad to see that it is in print.
And I am so happy to be talking to you about it. And disclaimer of my own, I did come to you when it was in infancy trying to brainstorm a title. And the title, I want everybody to know, it's actually your idea.
Well, I love the title, and I came up with the title. I spent a lot of time, I do these books all the time. I can't read cover to cover every single one, but I really loved your book. It is honest, it is practical, it is well-researched, and most importantly, it is very, very funny. I actually did a spit take when I read the sentence, insurance is a borgasm. Like, I actually spat out the water that was in my mouth. What compelled you to write this book?
What compelled me to write this book was, originally, I wanted to consolidate all of my knowledge about personal finance into some sort of fun, great guide. But there are a lot of those out there, including yours. And so it sort of hung around with my literary agent and in my head for a few years. And then I had a it's not a tragedy. I had a
crisis.
An unfortunate crisis in my life that inspired most of the story and most of the book. And the reason why I went on the happiness journey.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about that. We've been on the show before. We've talked about it. Your husband had a mental health crisis.
He did. We had just gotten married. And I mean, I permandated him for 10 years. So it's not like I was expecting anything out of the ordinary. But he had a bad reaction to sleeping pills and fell into a deep depression. He had anxiety and suicidal ideation and was eventually hospitalized. And during that time, Sean is the happy one out of the two of us.
Saying something.
He makes me laugh every single day. And in that time, the only thing I could think of to do was to try to be happy. And so I went on this quest to learn everything that I could, because I'm a journalist. I download information into my brain to try to help other people and to help myself. And so I learned everything I could about positive psychology. And this book is a culmination of that and money.
Now, the other through line in the book, you've suffered a series of miscarriages. So it's not that you have had some easy hooray for everything privileged life. You really have been in the trenches for many, many years. When do you first remember that you had a role to play in your own happiness, that it was actually something that you could do something about versus just, wait for all the treats to be delivered by Amazon Prime to your door?
Well, I think I remember having a conversation with my best friend about it was when my husband was extremely sick, and she asked me to rate my happiness on a scale of 1 to 10. And I said, after relaying some horrible story to her, I said a 7. And she thought, oh, my God, your life is a 7, then mine's a 12.
Right.
And I realized in that moment that all of the tools that I had used to try to bring myself to a happier state were actually working, because when I wrote the book, some early feedback that I got was that almost a year, you know, it's so nice. You're a seven. Yay, you. But, you know, other people may be a three. And I thought, I am naturally a three. You know, I'm a worrier. Mm. I went into journalism so I can professionally complain.
Right. And so, put yourself in environments where all sorts of terrible things are happening.
Yes, doom and gloom every day. It bleeds, right? And so my own personal journey. Yes, I mean, nobody's life is a walk in the park, right? Everybody has to deal with their own struggles. And so for me, it was just a conversation that I wanted to have with others about, okay, well, how are you trying to get happy? I bet you're trying to buy it.
Mm. And that don't work. Now, you said that even in your worst times, that you never worried about money, paying your bills, or losing your home. Why not?
Correct. Because I had set our finances up in a way when my husband and I got married that unknowingly at the time that basically insulated us during that storm. And so we bought the sliver of the townhouse with the triangular shaped rooms you can't fit beds in. Like, I didn't want that house in the boonies. But we bought it because we could afford it on one income because we thought it would give us opportunities to stay home with a kid. One of us would not work. I had disability insurance. We pulled some emergency funds, which came in handy because when Sean was looking to go to a treatment center, they start $10,000. They're expensive.
Yeah.
And we wanted to do everything we could to get him back to a stable place. And finally, we skipped our honeymoon because we had paid off our wedding in cash and we didn't want to go into any kind of debt because he is very averse to debt and so am I. And that, all of those things, when the storm came a couple months later, we didn't have debt to worry about. We didn't worry about losing our home. We didn't worry about not being able to pay for the things that really mattered in that moment.
You have become a deeply grateful person as I read through the book. And we're going to talk about specific money tips in a second. But fundamentally, you've taken on some practices to foster that gratitude. Tell us about some of the specific things that you've found or have tried, the Bliss app, the 5-Minute Journal. What are some of the things that you found work?
I think that people just think, oh, I'm going to be happy. I'm just going to wait until life delivers me this event, or when I make a certain amount of money, I'll finally be stress-free and I'll be happy. And it's cliche to say, actually, happiness is work. You know, it's basically how you view the world. And there's a lot of studies that show and a lot of research that shows that, you know, a certain percentage, a huge percentage of your own well-being is actually how you interpret things. And so, yes, there are lots of apps. There are meditation apps. There are, the 5-Minute Gratitude Journal, which is great. I personally find that when I try to force myself to do those things, it becomes work. But I've tried to foster habits that I practice daily. And some of those habits include pausing in the beginning of the day and the end of the day to go over the things that went well. Three things that went well that day. It was a study that was done by some Harvard professors that proved to be very effective in boosting people's general happiness over a long-term period. Every day, and at the end of every day, three things that went well. And it's also tied into gratitude, to standing and being still for a moment and being grateful for whatever it is. So, you know, this weekend I was in a car accident, and the only thing that I can think of, and that car is new. It's a used car. I just bought it the week before.
Ugh.
And the only thing that I can, the only thing I can think in that moment is I'm grateful that I'm okay. I'm grateful that my unborn child is okay. And the rest is money that thankfully I planned for. I have a little bit of fun to boat me in case something happens.
One of the things you talk about is the difference in your temperaments in terms of your financial behavior. Your husband is a ninja at online shopping, and you're a ninja of your own, except for yours is dumpster diving and selling your discoveries on Kijiji, which I could completely picture. How did you bridge the gap in the relationship?
For making me sound like I'm disgusting.
I'm sure you changed your clothes after
garbage.
You got out of the dumpster. And then you probably went and went to Value Village and bought a new outfit, right?
I was careful not to touch the sides of the dumpster. Anyways, there are lots of reasons. There's lots of reasons that misers actually marry people who spend a lot of money. There's something about the opposite side of track. But further science reveals that those differences do not translate into a a healthy marriage because it's conflict. It's fundamental conflict with values that will not change. And so my husband values stuff and I do not. And so that is an everyday, it's a struggle and has been a struggle and continues to be a struggle. But in that is the lesson that I've had to learn, and through my book, I'm doing that as well, continue to do that, is that just because I'm hoarding or just because I'm spending my time diving into dumpsters, I don't always do that. But that may not be, you know, that may not actually add up when it comes to happiness. Yeah, I'm saving a few bucks driving around to, you know, looking for the cheapest gas, but I need to put a value on my time, because if you value time over money, research shows that you are a happier person.
You've got a whole list of happy money to-dos. At the end of each chapter, there's a whole sort of call to action. What are some of the ones that might be less conventional that you recommend that some of your readers would be like, really? I'm doing that?
Okay. I don't want to sound like I'm going to dive into a Deepak Chopra blog post. But one of the things that is becoming more conventional is meditation and mindfulness. And so it is, I understand there is a chapter in my book that's called Invoke the Dalai Lama. And it talks a little bit about mindfulness. It gives an example of a gratitude or a meditation or a kindness exercise, I guess. And I think, you know, personal finance diehards might read that or open that and think, what is this touchy-feely wellness stuff in here? But if you look at the way that a lot of people spend money, it's done mindlessly. Mm. If you look at the way that people spend money, it's done in response to pain. Why are you buying that thing? Because I'm stressed, because I deserve it, because I'm alleviating some sort of pain, right? And so if you want to tackle some of the stress in your life, then scientifically, one of the most successful ways to do that is to incorporate more mindfulness in your life. And I'm not saying go join some sort of silent retreat for a week. I'm saying that
that wouldn't be a bad idea.
I don't know if I could do that.
I should do it together. It would be even harder because I could never do it. And because you're as extroverted as I am, we would both suffer together in pain.
I think the whole week would be like miming. Like it would just be charades all week.
Right. Or writing on pieces of paper and passing notes. But then we could write a book together about our week of silence. Such a good idea I just came up with.
We put the pressure on us to actually succeed.
I want to underscore for readers, we have been talking about some of the happiness components, but this is a book that is grounded in research and it's grounded in really important personal finance lessons. So it isn't a Deepak Chopra book, but I do want to include one other thing that I think is so delightfully wacky about your past, and that is your teen vampire fiction. And here's how I'm going to link it. What role do your two teen vampire books, which have sold 70,000 copies, by the way, under a pseudonym, how does that connect to your happy money method?
Well, I think that if you are going to allocate some more money to some goals like debt repayment, which absolutely will make you happier because debt is a massive stressor on someone's life, then you might want a side hustle. And huge, huge numbers of people are joining the side hustle phenomena across North America. Everybody has something that they do on the side to make a little extra money. And if I'm going to talk about happiness, then my advice would be to find a side hustle that fulfills other needs. You know, so maybe it's not just giving you extra money, but it's giving you some sort of joy, some sort of fulfillment another way. And I love writing. And so that was my passion. It was my side passion that became surprisingly more successful than I ever thought I imagined.
Fantastic. Melissa Leong, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Melissa is the author of Happy Go Money, an extraordinary new book that will have you think very differently about your happiness, about your money, and about your life.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Our family was built through open adoption. My husband and I completed the home study, the police checks, the medical tests, all so that we would be eligible to be chosen by a birth family. It took a lot of patience, but after a few years of waiting, we brought our dear daughter Abby home, and she is the best child in the history of the world. Even when she's not the best child, she's the best child in the history of the world. And while I would say that becoming parents was priceless for us, in reality, of course, it was not priceless. In most cases, there is a cost to go through the process. So today we're going to take a closer look at how to plan your finances so you can build your family. Our guest is Jennifer Myers. She is a financial advisor with SageVest Wealth Management and an adoptive parent herself. She joins us from McLean, Virginia. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
Tell us about your family. Was adopting a big decision for you?
I think adopting is a big decision for anyone, just as starting a family is a big decision. So it took a lot of research and time and financial diligence. But it's a wonderful decision and a wonderful path to follow.
Yeah. There are so many different ways that someone could pursue adoption. They could pursue a domestic adoption, an international adoption. They could work with the children's services in the community that they're from. So the costs vary significantly, but certainly there is a cost to most of them. How do you factor in the money when it comes to choosing a path?
Well, it's a very good question, and you have to be financially prepared because there are definitely costs involved to adopting. Just as with anyone, whether or not you're adopting or you're looking at starting a family, the first thing is having a financial plan and knowing how financially ready you are, which is just important for anyone at any age in life if you're over 18, frankly. Mm. But, you know, sitting down, working with an advisor ideally, and knowing, you know, are you setting aside enough? Do you have the financial resources to adequately cover your existing bills, to have the money that you need, and including some contingency plans? Because as an adoptive parent or somebody pursuing adoption, you have to understand that some adoptions work smoothly, some don't, some have bumps along the way, and those can be financial or other. So you have to have some buffer financially, and then also making sure that after you become an adoptive parent that you have the financial resources to be a good parent. Mm. In terms of, you know, buying diapers, formula, clothing,
yeah.
And
yeah,
the
yeah.
goes on.
So many financial goals that people have, like retirement, you know, vacations, a home, all that. They're worthy and wonderful goals. But building a family is, it's in many ways a separate category, because if someone were to ask me, like, how do I sort out my money to build my family through adoption, I would just tell them to sell a kidney on the open market. Or, I don't know, like the extent to which I would recommend they make these sacrifices to make it happen would be different from almost any other financial goal out there, because I'm so passionate about it. How do you combine the emotional element of building a family with the practical element of there needs to be a check to cover the home study?
So you bring up an excellent point, and it's one that honestly comes up with a lot of our clients, regardless of if adoption is in the cards or not. The reality is that a lot of people need to make decisions and prioritize different things financially in life, and adoption includes a little bit more prioritization of goals and financial objectives. So if you want to have the resources to adopt, I might not recommend selling a part of your body.
I was only mostly kidding.
But you might make decisions of, you know, what's more important? Do you want to take an exotic trip or have a luxury car, or do you want to have a child as part of your life? And those are some, like I said, discussions that we talk about with all individuals. But if you need to set aside resources to make this life objective happen, then it might be a balancing act with other elements.
What advice do you have on taking on debt to make this happen? Because certainly when we think about less conventional ways to fund your family, surrogacy, adoption, they have a cost, and there are ways to borrow to bring those goals to life. How would you navigate that?
So I become very cautious when I think about taking on debt. You really have to evaluate what your, if there's going to be a dramatic improvement in your financial situation going forward, which sometimes we hope those will happen and sometimes they materialize and they don't. But as I mentioned earlier, once you become a parent, your expenses continue to grow. So if you're having trouble financing the costs right now, you just need to make sure that you're going to be able to adequately raise the child and have the resources to do that. So I'd be very cautious about taking on debt unless you, you know, I'd want to have a backup plan. Mm. So perhaps check with family members and make sure that you have an out that you can still take care of that child longer term.
How do you help clients manage their expectations? So if I was talking to a social worker who worked with parents, they would have a whole set of things that they would work with their clients to help them manage the emotional weight. But in this case, this is a investment, air quotes, investment, in which they may not get the return for years. And even when they try and lower their bar and say, okay, it's going to be 4 years, might not be four, it might be seven. As a financial advisor, how do you help provide the support on that, given that it's an investment unlike any other?
Good question. What I talk about is the fact that adoption, as I mentioned earlier, does have risks in terms of timing, in terms of revocation, a number of different things. So you need to go into it with open eyes without having, you know, lofty expectations, or if you do have financial constraints, making sure that you're making wise decisions in how you're pursuing adoption so that you can protect yourself financially and emotionally, and really being cognizant of what kind of risks you can take on and what you can't take on or what you're not willing to take on. It's always a balancing act.
What are some of the pitfalls for people as they pursue the adoption path? What should they know from a financial perspective, the things that they should endeavor to avoid?
Well, you know, the pitfalls, the biggest pitfall is that something's going to change. If you're pursuing international adoption, I have friends who were overseas and the laws changed while they were there and they got stuck there for months. Mm. So you really need to be cognizant of what's going on with that country. If you're working on a private adoption and working with a birth mother, you know, understanding what revocation rights she has, and then knowing financially, I think a big thing to talk about with whomever you're working with is understanding if an adoption does fail, where do you stand in terms of your finances, about a second attempt, and in terms of timing, where you might lie in the structure.
Such a great topic. And Jennifer, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about it with us today.
Sure.
Jennifer Myers.
Both of our hearts.
It absolutely does. I could talk about it all day, every day. Jennifer Myers, financial advisor with Sagevest Wealth Management, and also, and perhaps even more importantly, an adoptive parent of two gorgeous girls herself. She joined us from McLean, Virginia. Coming up next on Moolala, we'll talk to Connor Richardson, CPA, author, and millennial, about his new book, Millennial Money Makeover, and later, a book that covers all the bases when it comes to a successful and secure retirement. So both ends of the age spectrum today. And if you want to see my face, who doesn't, right? And also hear my voice. I'm the money columnist for Cityline, which is a daily lifestyle TV show on air across North America. You can find our segments on cityline.tv. Then search for me, Bruce Selry, like the vegetable, with an S.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A lot of millennials are overwhelmed when it comes to their finances, and the idea of achieving financial freedom can seem totally out of reach. Author and millennial Connor Richardson shares some strategies on how to turn your finances around in his new book, Millennial Money Makeover. He joins us now from Austin, Texas. Hello there.
Hello, great to be here.
You embarked on your own financial makeover after an epiphany in New York City. You were working there, really excited about your life, and you had this epiphany. What was it?
Right. So I call this epiphany my financial awakening. So as you alluded to, I have been working in New York for about 4 years for a really large accounting firm, and I was enjoying life. Things were going great. But then one day, about 4 years into this, I sat down to really get a handle on where my finances were and sat down to do my budget for really the first time and doing the budget of me. But I hated what I saw staring back. And so I had this moment of realization that things had to change and they needed to change quickly. And that's when my money makeover started.
What was staring back at you? Was it debt, or was it just the harsh realization that it was going to be very difficult for you to build wealth in that city?
It was a little bit of both. So some credit card debt sprinkled in there, along with the realization that I couldn't get where I wanted to go and where I'd always hoped to go based off the current path I was on. So I needed to reduce my fixed costs and really think about producing multiple income streams and things like that.
There is a lot of talk about this generational dynamic, and a lot of it comes from people who are not in the demographic. What would you say is accurate from your experience about how millennials think about and behave when it comes to money?
So I think one of the things that millennials get pegged with is that they're very poor with money. And that's not really particularly true. Millennials have a different outlook when it comes to money in general. So they value money in different areas than other generations. So, for example, over 60% of millennials will spend money happily on a $3 coffee. 70% want to dine out at the finest restaurants in town. So they really value these experiential purchases over the more traditional life stage purchases, like buying a home for the first time and things like that. So it's just a matter of how they're spending their money, not that they're bad managing it.
You have a whole list of what you call makeover principles of success. There are 10 of them. We can't go through all 10, but number 3 is cash is forever king. What do you mean by that?
I mean that a lot of people get sucked into the belief that using a credit card or using debt in life is somehow a good thing, that you sort of need to build up your credit. But the reality is, to build up a solid financial foundation, you need to go through a couple different steps. And the first step really is making sure you're debt-free. The second is starting that emergency fund and distancing yourself from the paycheck-to-paycheck lifestyle. And then building up what I call a slush fund of 3 to 6 months of living expenses. And then once you do that and you're debt free, you want to stay what I call in the black from that point on. So cash speaks in large volumes. It's great for negotiating large transactions and getting great discounts, and it will serve you well.
Time is always on your side is one of your other principles of success. What do you mean? Because when I read that, I was like, wait a second. No, it's not. You have to get moving now, because otherwise you're going to miss the magic of compound interest.
Right. Well, the reality is that for millennials, so those are people in their 20s and 30s, we still have a long way to go. And your point is absolutely spot on. We want to take advantage of that compound interest for decades. But the fact of the matter is, if you're 30 or you're 35, you still have plenty of time to turn around your finances and lead what will eventually be the rich life for you. So it's the idea that there's no time like the present, and you can do this.
Learning from experience is too slow is one of your other principles. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite ones. So there's no need to go through the drudgery of self-experience. And what I've done in Millennial Money Makeover is I've looked at a lot of the latest in academic literature as well as industry data and boiled down into a 6-step program that people can follow in sequential order exactly what they need to completely turn around their finances and put their collision with success in an expedited fashion. So just follow the sequence, and the formula is proven.
One of your tactics is what you call passion budgeting. Is that analogous to joy-based budgeting or some of the other phrases that are in that milieu?
Yes. So it's the concept of aligning. So everybody has to spend money, and how you spend money matters a great deal. So it's aligning how you're spending money with what you're actually interested in. So if you are one who loves going to concerts or dining out if you're a foodie. It's making sure that you add those funds into your budget while you're cutting other areas that you don't really care about, but you're spending money for some reason. So it's requiring the person to be intentional and purposeful with how they spend their money to get them through this turnaround process.
What of your steps do you think exposes you to the most criticism from those in your generation? And I ask because one of them is around big purchases. You are not a fan of buying a brand new car. And I think culturally, there are a lot of people who are like, hey, Connor. So which of your pieces of advice do you think expose you to the most criticism?
That's a great question. So I think the answer is my take on home buying. So for millennials, we change jobs every 3.7 years, and we value flexibility, and the white picket fence in suburbia is not the end-all be-all of the success sequence for us. And so I set up a list of a couple different criteria that I think that you should follow before buying a home. And one of them in particular is saving 1 to 2x your household income before you go into this transaction. And I really say that for two reasons. The first is that if you can accumulate this amount of investments or cash, then it's an excellent proxy of comparison into how long it's actually going to take you to pay off that mortgage,
wow,
which you should absolutely do. And then the second is that millennials aren't valuing, that typical home for 30 years, but instead they're shifting their priority to retiring early and trying to chase that financial independence. So it's reversing the order of making sure you have your financial base set first and then going into the transaction with eyes wide open.
Really interesting. Connor, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Connor Richardson is the author of the new book, Millennial Money Makeover. He was in Austin, Texas. Coming up later, we're going to take you through the Moolala How I Do It segment with the author of Happy Go Money, Melissa Leong. But next, you had better be nice to grandma, because 1 in 8 Canadians change their will based on the behaviors of their beneficiaries. We'll talk to the producer of the CBC show, The Stats of Life. And if that's not enough Moolala for you, you can pick up one of my books online. The first is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Statistics alone are crazy boring, so boring. But statistics as a part of storytelling can be fascinating. That is the aim of The Stats of Life, a CBC show on CBC television, now in its second season. Sirius producer Kip Spadel is back to tell us more about some of the stories that they are telling that relate to money. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
For those of people who haven't seen Stats of Life yet, tell us a bit about how the show works.
Well, Stats of Life, Bruce, is a documentary series where each episode has a theme, money, homes, retirement, and then we follow three Canadian families and their lives as it relates to that theme, with one of those families being statistically average.
And the other two?
The other two not
crazy,
so average.
Crazy outliers.
The craziness. Yes.
They have 12 pets. And so we're going to go through some of the stats that relate to Canadians' financial lives. The first one is 51% of retired Canadians said they regret their financial decisions in the years leading up to retirement. Did that kind of fit with what your gut said?
Pretty much
about
so.
Half.
Absolutely. About half just didn't save enough money.
They just didn't save enough money. And yet, here's the other one that will magnify that regret. The average person can expect to spend 22 years in retirement, but only a quarter of those who are already there are totally happy with it. Now, that's disappointing.
Well, it is. Absolutely.
What did you learn in talking to the family? Was one of your families a retired family?
Oh, but three of them were retired.
All three were retired. Okay.
Absolutely.
And what did they say qualitatively about that?
All of them made an issue about loneliness. It wasn't really about money as much as the issue of making sure their social circles are well, because it's about health.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Had any found any tricks?
Well, the ones that plan first and plan longest are happiest now. It's the people that put money aside for the last 10, 15 years of their working life, that really worked their RSPs, played their pensions right, who had workplace pensions, which is a smaller percentage now than there ever used to be.
So. The stat you have on wills mirrors what I have heard pretty well everywhere else, which is somewhere around 50% of Canadians don't have a will. You've got an additional piece of context here. 1 in 8 admit to having adjusted the terms of their last will and testament because of the way their beneficiaries behaved.
Absolutely.
Did your people on the program talk about that?
No, that's an interesting stat that we came up with. None of them would admit to actually.
Of course not. They would never do that. They love every single member of their family, and they hope Aunt Susie gets the jam cupboard.
That'd be nice to grandma.
What do you think about that? I mean, it makes sense that we would change our will according to the way beneficiaries behaved. Did that surprise you? That was a number?
It did. Actually, it's a bigger number. It's either a larger amount of pettiness or a lot of people that can't make any changes in their lives while they're alive and waiting for that final little ha-ha, gotcha at the end.
48% of Canadians say they've had money problems, I assume sometime in the past,
mm-hmm.
and 38% have credit card debt. That's pretty consistent.
It is.
In the stories that you were filming as a part of the show, was credit card debt a theme?
It was. It was certainly, there was a couple of family, one family specifically in Slave Lake, Alberta, who had almost over $100,000 in what they call consumer debt.
How did you find the families and how did you get them to talk to you?
That's the biggest surprise of mine. It's a fact, over 800 people, about 800 families.
Did you bring edibles? Is that what you did? Like after you cast them, you're like, here's a brownie. It's going to be great. You know,
only after October 17th.
Right. October 17th. So you had lots of people apply, and then so that you choose them. How did you find your way in to having these? Because it's very intimate, these conversations.
It's remarkable how many doors the CBC opens for you just by saying working for the CBC. People inherently trust you and trust that you're going to take their information and do decent things with it, not misrepresent them, not make them into something they aren't. And we walked in with people already giving us that trust, and we strive very hard to make sure we don't lose it.
How do you, as a TV producer, what's the experience to you of finding the story underneath the data point? Because I talk about these surveys all the time, and I'm actually quite kind of at the end of my rope on the surveys because there's no context. What I love about your show is there's context. So how was that for you as a producer to be able to put some meat on those bones?
Well, we start with the meat and then we add the stats. I mean, we make sure there's a story there, make sure those people have something to say. They're good on camera, they're interesting, and their stories actually has a progression over the course of the days we're filming with them.
And there isn't a reality TV intervention. You don't have them sort their money in jars. You don't have them do challenges.
Nope.
Tell us about that. How did the format evolve such that, did anyone say, you got to make them use jars?
not this time. No, it certainly was documentary style. We're actually looking at the way Canadians actually live themselves, not pretending to put a producer's spin on how people should behave, but just watching how they do it. And then we compare that to the rest of Canada and how the rest of Canadians are behaving.
So retirement is a theme we talked about. We talked about savings. Are there any other statistics in the financial realm that were particularly compelling to you that you thought, oh, that's an interesting one. I didn't know that.
Well, 62% of people love tapping their debit card. That is the favorite way to pay across Canada now.
Do you mean they love tapping their debit card or that they tap their debit card? Because those are two different things. There are two different things. Some people just do it and some people relish in it. Are you talking about 60%? That's just how they behave?
Just how they behave.
Yeah, really high.
Just as a way to pay for things.
Yeah, and absolutely. I'm sure if we were to sort that by age, if it was anybody under the age of 25, it would be close to 100%.
Pretty well.
This is season 2, as I mentioned. How do you think about the financial – and it is a show that includes lots of other things, not just money data points. How do you think about future shows and things that you want to cover, questions that you want to ask that you haven't had a chance to ask yet in the financial realm?
Well, the financial realm, every show lends us to the next one. We're doing a show this year on selling homes. I think maybe next year we might consider buying homes.
Yeah.
We're talking about savings and debt this season. Maybe next year it's investing. Things lend themselves to the next one really easily in this, and being a generalist makes it fun to find them.
The show is called The Stats of Life. Series producer Kip Spittel, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
It airs on CBC Fridays at 8:30, 9 in Newfoundland and Labrador on CBC and also on CBC Gem. 8-part, 30 minutes. Tune in. Stay with us. Coming up next, your complete guide to a successful and secure retirement with author Larry Swedrow. And how I do it, this is this Moo La La feature where we take a financial expert and ask them what they actually do. Pull back the curtain and tell us what they actually do. You can track me on social media, Twitter at Bruce Celery, Facebook, Bruce Celery, Moo La La. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moo La La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Thousands of books have been written on the topic of retirement. Even I wrote a book on retirement. Larry Swedrow has written 17 books, including this one. It's Your Complete Guide to a Successful and Secure Retirement. He joins us now from St. Louis, Missouri. Hello there.
How you doing, Bruce?
Your complete guide. That is a big promise. What makes yours complete?
Well, there are a lot of books on retirement, as you noted. Many of them focus on either investing or estate planning or a few issues. I was searching for a book that covered the full ground, including planning a life in retirement, as well as issues like elder abuse, cognitive decline, pension plans, medical insurance, all kinds of things. And I didn't find one, so I thought I could take the task on, and I recruited, I think, an all-star team of people who had expertise in various areas, including authors of books on the subjects they're writing, to put this book together.
Are there some happy topics in there? Geez, dementia, elder abuse. A lot of people have quite a good life in retirement.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That I would bet those people have planned to have a good life. Sadly, too many of us don't plan for that. And because it's been found that we get our fulfillment in life, a sense of intellectual stimulation, our social connections come while we're at work. So if we don't plan to continue those things going forward when we retire, bad things happen. Mm. In fact, the highest suicide rate is not teenage girls any longer. It's retired men.
I saw that statistic. It was shocking and heartbreaking in equal measure. You write in your book, people spend less time planning for retirement than for a vacation. I don't know if that's true quantitatively, but it's worrying. Even just the sentiment is worrying. If there was one element, I'm going to force you to choose from all these topics that you talked about. If there was one part of the plan which you believe is the most under thought through, under planned for, what would it be?
I think it's a lack of planning for a fulfilling life in retirement.
Yeah, like activities. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? For example, most people, or at least I think it's even a majority, say they're going to do charitable work, and yet less than something like a third or a quarter actually do it. You have to put together a plan. I worked with author Alan Spector, who wrote a wonderful book, Your Retirement Quest, which is kind of a guidebook, and it gives you exercises to do, including envisioning that perfect day in retirement and then practicing it before you actually get there.
You have a new spin on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, the retirement version. High equity valuations, low bond yields, increased longevity risk, risk of long-term care. I want you to talk about the longevity risk piece.
Well, that's the good news and the bad news at the same time.
Yeah.
The good news, of course, is we're living longer and we're living healthier lives in general. The bad news is, of course, number one, you need a larger pot of money when you retire because you're living longer. The average 65-year-old healthy average couple has a second-to-die life expectancy of almost 25 years, and that, of course, means half will live longer. So you need to plan at least 30 years. And sadly, as we age, the risk of needing long-term care and the risk of cognitive decline increase dramatically, and you need to plan for those extra expenses, not only of just living longer, but of living near the end of your life with a much more expensive bill to pay.
You outline a bunch of risks, including something that you call sequence risk. What do you mean by that? Now, we're in the investing realm. What do you mean by sequence risk?
So what most people don't understand is when you're in the accumulation phase, it pretty much doesn't matter the order of returns. So you could have the first 10 years be poor and the next 10 years be great. It most cases, it doesn't matter. On the other hand, when you retire, actually the vast majority of your success or not of your plan happens in the first 5 years of retirement. And the reason is if you start out with bad years and the portfolio drops sharply like a 2008 or 2002, the problem is your portfolio is collapsing and then you're withdrawing money to pay for your lifestyle, and when the market eventually recovers, you can't recover as much because that money has been spent. So this is what's called sequence risk. So while stocks over the long term, for example, have gotten about 10%, and bonds, say, 5 or 6, so an average for a portfolio of 8, you really could not have been withdrawing more than about 6% a year, even accounting for inflation, and without running a high risk of running out of money.
So how do you mitigate that?
Well, you, number one, probably today should start with a portfolio that's, my recommendation is, about 30 times what your spending need is once you account for your pensions. In the U.S., that would be mainly Social Security. Mm-hmm. So if you needed $60,000, we're getting $30,000 from Social Security. Your net need is $30,000 a year. You need about $900,000, or you should not be retiring or shouldn't be planning on that.
You also talk about the risk of failing to provide for a spouse. When you look at the mortality tables, what the actuaries would say is that spouse is more likely to be a female.
Absolutely. Women have a longer life expectancy. And as we point out on the women's chapter, unfortunately, when they are widowed or divorced, and the fastest rate of increase or cohort of divorces is what is called silver divorces. And women tend not to remarry as often as men. And that means they have a much more expensive nut to hit because two can live cheaper than one. So that's another problem that we all face or that we can face.
I want to finish on a positive note because there are so many risks, there's so many factors, there's so much to plan. What is one thing you're excited about this time in your own life?
Well, the great thing for me is I'm not planning to retire, at least not from life. I found that I get great joy out of my work. And the day it becomes work, not enjoyment, will be the day I will retire. But I've been lucky in my life, and I get to help people. I get emails from people all over the world thanking me for helping them through my books and answering their questions and emails. So any of your listeners, pick up a copy of book. No, I'm always happy to answer their questions.
That's great. Larry, thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Larry Swedbrow is the author of Your Complete Guide to a Successful and Secure Retirement, and he joined us from St. Louis, Missouri. Now's the time for How I Do It. It is our series of very basic questions about how our guests manage their personal finances. And I will reiterate, I wouldn't ask anyone any question that I would not answer myself. So those questions go to Melissa Leong, personal finance expert and the author of Happy Go Money. Melissa, just the first thing that comes to your mind. You ready?
I am ready.
You buy coffee or tea. You're pregnant. Maybe it's tea. You buy coffee, tea, or some beverage at a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit?
I pay with debit. I tap my debit card because it's associated with my spending account. So if there's money in there, coffee for me, coffee for you, Bruce.
Do you still use cash for anything?
I do when I give money to my son to buy things. He's 4, and so I want him to learn about I want him to feel the tangible the tangibleness of cash.
Yeah. And just but is it pretty much out of your life aside from that?
Yes.
Yeah. What about your financial life is automated? Bills, retirement savings, vacation savings. What have you automated and what have you not automated?
Almost everything is automated because I don't want to deal with looking at, okay, this is how much I got left over. This should go here. I've automated everything. As I've just mentioned with my spending account, I've automated that too. So money just automatically goes into the debit, that this specific checking account that's associated with the debit card. And if there's money there, I spend it. I don't worry about it. I'm not fussed about savings because I've already done that.
I took off the automation on the payment of my telecom bill. So my credit cards are still automated, but I took off the telecom bill because I found that was the one where mysterious charges often would show up, like, oh, I had a discount on my plan and then it disappeared. And it also is a reminder that I have to check that bill because I need to constantly be looking for when my contract's going to be done and I'm going to look for a cheaper alternative down the road.
Right. A lot of my things are automated, but I do get a lot of emails. I find them annoying, but at least then I would get – that's when I would see where my bill was – something was awry. Mm.
You have a great degree of sophistication around many parts of your life. You have income properties. Do you have an actual financial plan, something written down? Could be done by you and Sean, could be done by a financial advisor, but sort of the document that reviews the current state and outlines the actions to get to some sort of a goal.
I do, but I have to admit it's probably a little bit outdated. So thank you. Thank you, Bruce.
You're welcome. Does it have a picture of Rob Lowe on the cover or something? Is Shakira featured in this financial plan? Like, what other early 90s references could I make?
We got married. But a lot of things have changed since then. So it does need an update.
Who manages your investments? Are you a DIYer, a robo consumer, customer, full service financial advisor? How do you get that done?
I am. So my personal money, I am a DIYer. I am also incorporated. And so my husband and I, that stays in the corporation, is run by an advisor.
Do you, on the DIY side, mutual funds, ETFs, stocks?
I have a mix of index funds and ETFs.
You hold income property, right?
I do.
What has been the best part of that? What has been the worst part of that?
The best part of that is having something that, I mean, I bought a condo pre-construction ahead of this massive boom in Toronto. And so that was great to see something that I purchased that was tangible, that I actually lived in, that I benefited from, to see that grow in value. The thing that I don't like, there's literally an email in my inbox right now saying that the doorknob fell off the bathroom. And what should the tenant do? And so I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to drag my 9-month pregnant body downtown to fix a doorknob. So
don't you just hit reply and say, use the bathroom in the lobby? That's what I would do. That's what I would say. Go to McDonald's.
Treat people the way you want to be treated. I would hope that somebody would come down immediately so I can, you know, go to the bathroom in private.
You're a better person than I. Who files your taxes?
I do.
Have you always done your taxes yourself?
No. Before, I used to just, I don't know, I mean.
You didn't file. You were just like an evader.
I was never an evader because I was always I am a very conscientious person. So I've never, I'm all about deadlines. But sometimes I would just take it. I mean, when I was starting out in my career, I would just take it H&R Block.
Right. You have a kid, a second on the way. Mm-hmm. What is the number one value you want to bring your children up with when it comes to
the money value?
Yeah. I mean, a value for trashy movies like your parents, but I mean, a money value.
You know what? My value, it's the same value that came from my parents. My parents they're immigrants. They worked, you know, my father worked 9 to 5 at his government job, and then he would work at the family restaurant afterwards. And so there's something to be said about hard work and enjoying the actual work. But I also need to balance that with my husband's values, which is money is meant to be enjoyed. Mm. So you work hard, but you also have to spend it on things that will give you a good life. I might, on my side, there might be a little bit of work hard and then save it.
Yeah.
Know, but,
right.
But I'm trying to achieve, I want my kids to be more balanced.
Some yin and yang. Melissa, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Melissa Leong, that is how I do it, how she does it. Melissa Leong, personal finance expert and the author of Happy Go Money. That is our show for today. If you want some more Moolala, you can download and subscribe to the podcast version of the show on all of the platforms out there, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, Spotify, all that kind of stuff. Please send us any comments, questions, thoughts, tips to our email address, ask@moolala.ca. Don't worry, be happy. Thank you for joining us and have a great day.